Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace.
And this is Jay.
And this is another Marvel Spotlight episode. We're going to be talking about six different Marvel comics that came out in 2019 that I have only recently read or reread. And we're going to basically give you a recap of the issue and kind of tell you what we thought. Now, a couple of episodes ago, we talked about Old Man Quill, number one. And I said, you know, I really didn't like it. I'm not a big fan of Star-Lord or Peter Quill or the Guardians of the Galaxy in general. And, you know, I recommended it for people that had read the story or were into Guardians of the Galaxy, fans of Peter Quill, fans of Star-Lord. They would probably get a kick out of it. I didn't get much out of it. And I said I wasn't going to read the second issue. But I felt guilty. And I've said this so many times on the podcast, I don't think you can judge a book purely on the basis of one issue. I think you always have to give it to, especially because a lot of times first issues are the hardest ones to do, right? Like you're trying to introduce characters to your audience if they're not familiar. And certainly, you know, the MCU has made Peter Quill and Star-Lord and the Guardians themselves much more known than previously, but you still got to write it in such a way that somebody coming to it for the first time, because they see that number one and they think, oh, I can just jump on it and I'll understand. So there are those challenges. Plus you have to get the narrative going. You have to establish setting, you know, where are your characters at? So they're very challenging. First issues are very challenging. So I was like, you know what? I can't go against my own advice. I got to go ahead and read the second issue. And I got to say, I'm glad I did. Second issue was a lot better than the first issue. There was a lot more emotion to it, and I actually really liked it. Now, will I read issue three? I haven't decided yet. I'm on the fence. Don't know if we're going to cover issue three. There's a chance that we will. Jay and I probably have to talk about it and see if, you know, because he's read it all. So, you know, see if he can convince me. Not that I might not need that much convincing, because, like I said, the second issue was a lot better. It's actually showing Peter Quill, Old Man Quill, as the title is, or Star-Lord, in a different light that's making him a lot more interesting to me than the previous. Let me crack some jokes. I'm sort of morally ambiguous and, you know, look at how whatever cool or funny or great I am. He's just not a character that does it for me. And if anything, the portrayal of him by Chris Pratt in the MCU movies has only made me like him less. Cause that's a lot of where his personality in the modern day comics come from. Because before the whole MCU thing, that's not how a Star-Lord acted. So you're getting kind of a Robert Downey Jr. Iron Man thing going on. And it's just, I'm never a big fan of that, especially when that person that's portraying them is just acting like an obnoxious jackass. So let me recap the issue real fast. We did see when Peter and the surviving members of the Guardians of the Galaxy, you know, they went and they woke Peter up and took him to Earth along with Mantis, and they ended up crash landing there. And we saw just this landscape of like this Mount Rushmore looking monument, but it was all doom. And it was called the Wastelands. So we're told in an editor's note early on in this issue that this takes place at a certain time relative to Old Man Hawkeye and Old Man Logan. So it's clear that we're sort of in that same sort of world, you know, that when you talk about the Wastelands, we're talking about, you know, a similar world where Old Man Logan and Old Man Hawkeye took place. So it gives you some context if you're, you know, a reader of those stories, if you're a fan. So this is a possible future of the Marvel Universe, and it's sort of a dystopian kind of a situation that they're in. So as I said, they crash landed. Not all the Earth is wasteland, though. Not all of America is wasteland. And so the issue actually starts off properly with seeing New Latveria, which was formerly New Babylon, which was formerly New York. And we do see around the planet Earth, there are various doom built defense satellites, I guess you will call them. They look very doom-esque. They're gray and green. And it was one of those defensive satellites that actually shot down the ship that the Guardians were on. And then as the camera zooms in to what would have been Times Square, and now I think it's called Doom Square in what was formerly New York, we see a lot of billboards up and they're saying, you know, Doom, save us all. There's a crowd gathering. And we see what appears to be Dr. Doom himself, and he's throwing out packs of food and water saying, remember, Doom shall save you all. Doom loves you. This is why Doom feeds you, for the greater good. And he's flanked by two armed guards, and there's a crowd around, and they're fighting over the food and fighting over the water that Doom's thrown out into the crowd saying, you know, we love you, Doom. Give us more. We're so hungry. Meanwhile, the guards there are sort of beating on people if they get too close. And we get one guy that comes up in a Fantastic Four t-shirt with a Molotov cocktail, and he yells, end Doom's tyranny, it's clobbering time. And he nails Doom directly in the chest with this Molotov cocktail, and Doom catches fire. And right away we realize it's a Doom bot, because he starts stuttering and there's static, and you know, he's saying violence has no place in New Liberia, order must be maintained, but there's static going on. And he just starts firing indiscriminately with his gauntlets at the crowd. So he fries the guy who hit him with the Molotov cocktail, but he also kills a bunch of other people too that were just innocent bystanders. So clearly, you know, not caring. Goes on about order must be maintained. Disrespect for Doom is not tolerated. Doom cannot look weak in front of his people. And maybe that's why the machine, the Doombot, obliterates more than just the guy. He doesn't want any witnesses, even to the point of he fries the guards. The armed guards that are there that work for Doom, he kills them as well, saying Doom cannot look weak in front of his people. And so there's nobody left. There's nobody left in this crowd. Doom, the Doombot has killed them all. And he continues to stutter, Doom loves you, Doom feeds you. And he starts throwing out more Doom meals and water, even though there's nobody left to collect them. And they fall on the ground next to these smoldering skulls of these people that have been killed. Meanwhile, out in the wastelands, we see those Guardians that did crash, that are being led to the nearest town of wherever they crashed. You know, we did see when they crashed that they crashed sort of at the feet of this indigenous person that lives out there in the wastelands. So Peter Quill, or Old Man Quill, you have Rocket Raccoon, you have Drax, you have Gamora, and you have Mantis, and then you have this companion of theirs that guided them to the next town. So they've been walking a long ways without any water, and Quill immediately starts running up to the town. And this guy's like, hold on, we don't know if there's any like hostile, whatever, but Quill's not having it. He's thirsty. He's been out in the sun and trekking a long way in this dusty, hot landscape. And there's a sort of a water fountain in the sort of the town square there. And Quill falls to his knees and starts drinking some water out of it when he realizes on the top level of the fountain is a severed head, and it's like dripping blood down into the lower levels of the fountain. He's like, yeah, so this is a thing, you know, this is clearly dystopia. This is not the way things should be. And we see on the wall painted in the background, to defy Doom is to defy life. So they say, well, it appears we've come all this way to save a planet that is already lost, is the way that Gamora puts it. And they look around and there's all these people in the town that are just kind of laying there dead. And based on the graffiti that you see on the wall, you figure, well, this village must have done something to piss off the forces of Doom. And just like the Doombot wiped everybody out, you know, the forces of Doom came here and wiped everybody out. So Quill's wondering how the Avengers could have let this happen. And their guide's like, what's an Avenger? And Mantis is telling him, you know, we don't have time for this. The priority is to find the relic that we came here to find, because we need to find that before the church comes, because the whole reason they're at Earth is to stop the Church of Universal Truth from coming and annexing Earth as a planet. So they decide they're going to walk to the next town to see if they can find any other answers. And they see a fire in the distance at the next town. They figure, okay, let's, you know, that smoke looks fresh. Let's go to the next town, look for answers. Their guide's like, you want to figure out how to survive in the wastelands? You walk away from where the fires are. And so they go their separate ways. Meanwhile, back in New Latveria, we actually get a peek into Doom's lair. And we see there's some lackey who's reporting to Madam Mask, who apparently is Doom's sort of right-hand person here, saying, there was just an attack an hour ago in Doom Square. And apparently the Doombot got damaged and it took out two of my men. And Madam Mask is like, you know, I don't want to hear about you complaining about two low ranking soldiers. You know, Lord Doom has a world to remake. He's got to worry about expanding and maintaining the empire. And, you know, surely you can figure this out. Do you have any, you know, real news, any actual urgent demands? And he's like, well, harvests in the wastelands have doubled. She's like, really? That's urgent? Okay, well, there was a spacecraft that crash landed. That interests Madam Mask. So he explains how it was shot down by one of the satellites. And based on the markings, it was not Skrull. It was not Chitauri. So not sure who it's from. And they certainly can't rule out if it's some part of some invading fleet to come. And they say, yeah, it's crash landed in the wastelands, a part of the land that's not yet under our control. And Doom kind of waves his hand, and Madam Mask takes that to mean Doom has nothing to fear from the spacecraft. But what's interesting, like, Doom has never been one to let others speak for him. So you kind of wonder what shape Doom is actually in. Like, is there something wrong with Doom that he's letting Madam Mask sort of call the shots here? I mean, the way Madam Mask sounds, she sounds like Doom. Like, was Doom's body failing? Did he put his consciousness into Madam Mask? Like, something's not right with Doom. He doesn't say a single word. And again, that's just not Doom's way to be so quiet. Meanwhile, out in the wastelands, we see that town where the smoke is basically being shaken down by the wrecking crew. And they're asking for the tribute that the town owns to Lord Doom. And they make some, the town people make some excuses. Well, you know, between the drought and Spider-Woman's raiders and, you know, you guys taking all of our stuff. And Wrecker's like, didn't we just have the same conversation last month? Like, he's not having it. He's like, no excuses. You need to pay up. And I guess we'll just, you know, beat the crap out of this town, kill everybody, and make it sort of an example, a message for the other towns. But the Guardians arrive just in time, and they basically fight off and sort of kill the Wrecking Crew. I mean, it's a pretty brutal fight, and the artwork doesn't leave much to the imagination. It's pretty brutal as well, even to the point of when there's only one member of the Wrecking Crew left, only Pile Driver's left, but he's a young Pile Driver. All the rest of the Wrecking Crew are these old men, and through the dialogue here, we find out that this Pile Driver is actually the grandson of the original Pile Driver. And he takes a little girl hostage and he's like, you're going to let me go and blah, blah, blah. And Peter Quill's not having it. He just pulls out his gun and shoots the guy in the head. And this aged Rocket's like, oh, well, a little darker than the Star-Lord I remember, but nice to know you're not completely gone. And Quill, noncommittal, just turns and walks away. And Rocket says, well, I guess I was wrong. Nope, he's still completely gone. And Mantis says, well, he's going to need to find his way back or he has no chance. Meanwhile, out near Jupiter, there actually is an invading fleet. It's the Forerunners or the scout ship for the Church of Universal Truth. We see Gladiator there. We see another girl. I can't remember what her name is, but I think she used to be part of the Shi'ar Royal Guard as well. And actually all three of these characters. There's also that mandroid looking guy that has the green one, like more robot looking guy that has the other little guy in his back. Can never remember what he's called either, but they basically say, yeah, we've tracked the Guardians of the Galaxy here, and it looks like Star-Lord is among them, and he's not quite the broken man we were led to believe, and maybe the church is right to fear him. So alert the church elders that we've found the next world to cleanse Earth. So, you know, it's Mantis's prophecy coming to life. So yeah, I think for me, the big part, and maybe it's just because Quill's hardly in this, and we're just getting instead a look at this future world that I find kind of interesting, and Quill has sort of shut down, and he's not talking and being obnoxious. Maybe that's why I liked it a little more, but I thought it was interesting, you know, and you know, Quill being on the ground and sort of seeing real life consequences, maybe it's bringing him back to remembering. And in fact, there is a flashback at one point where he sees a couple of kids interacting with their parents, and he has a flashback to himself interacting with his kids back from the world where he used to be emperor. So, you know, maybe we're getting a little more depth to Peter Quill that we're going to establish kind of in a slow burn. So I'll give credit to writer Ethan Sachs. The second issue is way better than the first one. The art is about the same. It's Robert Gill art. He doesn't have the cleanest art style. To me, his art's just okay. The colors by Andrus Mossy are pretty bleak and sort of dried out, which you would expect when you're talking about, you know, a dystopian world. So they're done well. It sort of suits the mood and tone of the story. Letters are by Joe Caramagna. He does a good job. There's not, you know, a lot special about the letters or anything, but it's all done well. The pacing is good. So yeah, I thought the second issue was a big improvement over the first issue. What were your thoughts on it, Jay?
Well, now that you like the second one, we've got to keep it going. It gets better. Trust me. Just got to finish the series, man. We got to do it. No, I was pumped up for it because, like I said, I've always been like Old Man Logan storyline. They sort of kind of following. So when they had the little spinoffs like this, it's like, well, I was on board for it. But you're right. It's a different look at Peter because he's not, you know, like he's like the silly guy he is. He's more older and more mature and kind of like, you know, different. He's more mature. I like the storyline. Like I said, it does get better and it shows a lot more what's going on in the wasteland, like, you know, the what if future, like I said, from Old Man Logan storyline. So that's what I liked about it a lot. And then, you know, you're right about Doom. You're like, hey, what's going on with this guy? Because when I first read it, I was like, how can he even say anything? He doesn't not say nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. He doesn't utter a word. And that's just not Doom. Doom loves to talk, loves to hear himself talk. So, yeah. Right away, you know, something's not right. Yeah. So interesting because I think you're right. This is a different Peter Quill. It's almost like, look at the original Star-Lord stories. Forget about all the stuff that comes in the middle that's all inspired by the Chris Pratt portrayal. Like, just leave all that out and then come to this. And you could fill that middle part in with anything that actually isn't influenced by the MCU. Because this Star-Lord was a pretty serious character when he, you know, was first introduced. You know, as serious as any comic character is, you know, he joked around a little here and there. There was a little bit of that, but nowhere near where they eventually took him. No. So this to me is an extension of that, you know, and it's kind of leaving out all the Chris Pratt stuff. So, all right. Well, I guess there you have it, listeners. We'll cover issue 3 on a subsequent Marvel spotlight. So, all right. What are we going to talk about next? Let's move on to Miles Morales, Spider-Man number 3. This was written by Saladin Ahmed. We have art by Javier Garon. Colors are by David Curiel and letters are by Corey Petit. So what's been going on so far in Spider-Man is Spider-Man's girlfriend's nephew was kidnapped and the Rhino's niece was kidnapped. And there's some sort of organization or villain or something that's kidnapping kids and brainwashing them to basically pull heists for them. And in the middle of this sort of situation that Spider-Man has teamed up with Rhino to solve, Miles Morales is also dealing with the fact that he just started another year of school and he's trying to make his relationship with his girlfriend work and he's trying to get all his schoolwork done, but he's trying to balance that with all this lack of sleep because he's always out fighting crime as Spider-Man at night and he's not getting any sleep and he's not doing well in school. And you know, he's got one of the vice principals of the school that doesn't seem to like him for some reason and constantly keeping an eye on him, which makes it hard for him to sneak off during school hours. So, you know, sort of that classic sort of Spider-Man story, right? Where you're talking about, you know, a character that's in high school that's juggling all these different responsibilities, you know, that it's hard enough being a teenager, you know, and becoming an adult and taking on more and more responsibility. And you're having more and more obligations. And on top of that, okay, you're this hero and you have other expectations and you're, you know, supposed to be fighting supervillains and all that. So you can imagine how tough things are for Miles right now. So we saw at the end of last issue, Captain America showed up. And here we find out that he's been told by his congressman that there's kids that are being, that are basically disappearing from the foster system. And so that's what sort of led him to the same spot where the Rhino and Spider-Man went last issue, because Spider-Man's pal Genki did a search on the dark web and found out that somebody was ordering a bunch of children-sized supervillain costumes from the dark web and having them delivered to this specific warehouse. And when they went there last issue, they ran into Tombstone. They were able to fight Tombstone off, and they were able to rescue some kids, but Peter's girlfriend's nephew wasn't there, and neither was the Rhino's niece. So clearly there's more going on than just this one kind of safe house where these kid villains were. So, so Cap's like ready to, accuse the Rhino, like, what's going on here? What are you up to? And Spider-Man's like, no, he's actually with me. We were working together. He's looking for his niece. Cap's like, okay, good enough for me, son. So Spider-Man definitely has the Miles Morales. Spider-Man definitely has the respect of Captain America. So they sort of trade notes and decide that, you know, they'll continue the investigation together. Now it's, you know, a team of three rather than just the team up of Rhino and Cap. They go outside. They use, it's kind of funny. Cap pulls out this phone. He's like, well, Tony Stark just built this new app for me on this special phone where I can get lab results instantly by, you know, analyzing tire tracks and things like that, but he can't get it to work. He's like, oh, I'm so confused. It's kind of low hanging fruit to make fun of, you know, Captain America, who's, you know, born in the, I guess, you know, late 1920s, early 1930s. It's kind of low hanging fruit to make fun of him not being able to work a phone, but be that as it may, Miles Morales pulls it out and says, yeah, phones are crazy these days, Cap. Let me help you out. So he analyzes these tire tracks. They have an idea of where in the city the truck may have gone. And so they head over to Brooklyn, and Cap's like, okay, it's Brooklyn, and there's some sort of residue that has to do with mutants. I know exactly where they must be. Apparently there was an old warehouse that was a secret SHIELD facility that was designed to hold mutants, not criminals, but just, you know, if ever something ever happened and they needed to. And you can tell Miles, that doesn't sit right with him. He's like, right here in the middle of Brooklyn, huh? Cap's like, well, it's not the only such place. And only a handful of us had a conscience and had the influence to make SHIELD shut these down. And of course it was hushed up afterwards. So they try to figure out what they're going to do next. And this part is sort of clunky. It didn't really flow. I kind of expect better things from Saladin Ahmed. One of the things that he's doing here is we're getting a lot of first person narration from Spider-Man. Miles Morales has taken a creative writing class. And as part of that, he's supposed to be keeping a journal. So once in a while, we'll get these little journal excerpts where we're getting him basically talking to us. We're hearing about his thoughts firsthand. And he's talking about how Cap asking Spider-Man, hey, what's the next move, like, blew his mind, right? And he's like, it's hard to explain. Just being around the guy makes you want to be better. And so for Cap to actually care about his opinion, you know, means a lot. But then the part where it gets kind of clunky is Spider-Man actually responds, well, you know, this is important and I've helped save the universe, but this is kids and it's personal. And you know what I'm saying? And then Cap's like, well, I snuck into the army when I was underage and I was terrified. And, you know, one thing I told myself when I was facing down Nazi machine gun nest is, you know, I don't know what I'm doing and I'm scared, but people need me and I've got to get this done anyway. And I don't know, it didn't flow. It didn't flow real well. I know it's supposed to be kind of this moment, but I think it would have been better just leaving us with the thoughts of Miles. Because he says, it's like he has a superpower, but it's just him, you know, the superpower to make you want to be your best. And that we can understand, this supposed moment he's trying to have between Cap and Miles kind of falls flat for me. It's just a little clunky. So anyway, Spider-Man decides, well, let me go scout ahead, right? Like, I have the ability to camouflage myself. And when the time comes, I'll call you guys when I need help. So he sneaks into the warehouse. He's immediately attacked by a kid. He calls in the cavalry and they're fighting against the kids, and the Rhino's about to lose it and pound on a kid. And Spider-Man's like, dude, calm down. They're just kids. He's like, okay. Sometimes the mad just kind of takes over. And so he webs everybody up and he's like, this is going to hold them for a little while, but they're still attacking even though they're held in place. And Spider-Man's like, huh, let me use a mild venom blast channeled through the webbing, and that should knock them out gently. And that'll give us time to figure out what's going on. And so that works, but it's before they can even get a chance to figure out what they're going to do next, a voice off panel says, guess I'll have to handle you losers myself. Then you can call me the Snatcher. And it's this, I mean, the most cliched supervillain, maybe, I don't know, ever. When you talk about some kind of right wing, fascist, just jerk, basically, you know, he's got tattoos all over his arms. He's got the big old beard, and he talks about how he snatched all these kids. He comes right out and says it. Yeah, I took all these kids, and he's like proud of it. Cap's like, you're the one that took these children? Yeah, you're damn right I did. You has been. And even Miles like, you're proud of this? They're innocent kids. Innocent? How are they innocent? I snatched them from the scum that sleeps on our streets, the dirt that ignores our borders, the garbage that fills their veins with poison. So, you know, this is just another fascist scumbag who, you know, populist America first dumbass who has no understanding of the way the world really works. You know, he's blaming the people that are homeless. So it's their fault they're homeless, you know, blaming immigrants who come here that do the jobs that Americans don't want to do. You know, guy's just a pure scumbag through and through. So they get ready to attack him, but he does have that ability to snatch people. And he uses it on the three heroes here, raises his sunglasses up. And but, you know, Captain America has one of the probably strongest will of anybody in the entire Marvel universe. So what happens is he starts breaking free right away. And the snatcher's like, what, you're breaking free? No way. Nobody's ever been able to do that. So he goes closer to Captain America and he's focusing all his energy on him. But what that does is that allows the Rhino and Miles to be free. So Miles has the Rhino lead the kids out to safety while he basically takes out the snatcher. But even though he's kind of webbed up and incapacitated, he still has control over all the kids. So what he does is he has all the rest of the kids that are still under his control come marching into the room, and they're all pointing their guns at each other. And this is where Rhino finally sees his niece, and Miles Morales finally sees his girlfriend's nephew. And Snatcher says, okay, you guys are going to let me go, or I'm going to have all these little cockroaches light each other up like the 4th of July. And Spider-Man's like, what? What is wrong with you? Like, please don't do this. You know, I'll do whatever you want. And Snatcher says, finally, you're talking some sense. Okay, first you and your friends are gonna, and before you can finish this sentence, we actually see Miles Morales' friend's nephew start to fight off the control as well. He says, no, I won't do this. And that, you know, having a kid tell somebody like this guy what to say, you know, that's definitely not going to sit right with him. So he's like, what did you say to me, you little piece of crap? And he realizes that his power is spread out too thin. Right. He's trying to control too many people, actively control too many people at once. It even says, there's too many of you losers. You're wearing down my concentration. And so we don't know what he plans on doing to remedy that situation. We never get a chance to find out because Miles, now that all the children have kind of started to kind of spaz out and they're not actively pointing their guns at each other, he says, well, what you're going to do is get venom blasted. And he punches him right in the gut with the venom blast, which must have been really satisfying to punch somebody like this guy who's a, you know, total scumbag. So Cap sort of is recovering. Miles has to help him to his feet, and it says his brain is still a little scrambled. And Cap makes a few calls, and he gets in touch with the congresswoman who put him on the case in the first place to see about getting the kids back to the families. And she talks about how it's going to be kind of complicated, but she'll do everything she can. The Cap and Rhino have a nice moment where Cap tells him, hey, you know, this is a lot better than being on the other side. You know, hope you continue down this path. And then he gets a call and he needs to head off to Romania. We're supposed to see Avengers number 14 for that story. And so Cap bids Spider-Man farewell. The Rhino and Spider-Man end on good terms as well, saying, you know, maybe we'll team up together again in the future. Meanwhile, back at school the next day, Miles's girlfriend is really happy that her nephew's back safe, but he's kind of down in the dumps about what happened. And so she's going to take him to see a movie later. And she drops a hint when she's talking about taking her nephew to see the movie. She goes, yeah, he, he just survived being kidnapped by a supervillain, but you wouldn't know anything about that, right, Miles? Only Spider-Man would know about that, right? And he's like, yeah, I mean, of course, but it's behind the scenes there. It's reading between the lines. Maybe I should put it that way. Maybe she knows. Maybe she suspects that he might be Miles. But anyway, she's like, do you want to come to the movie? Oh, of course I do. So they go, they see the movie later, and we get a little excerpt again from Miles's journal, and it's talking about the quote that the original Spider-Man tells him all the time: with great power, there must always come great responsibility. So he's talking about how he's been to other planets. He knows androids and demigods, but when you want to get real, more important than alien invasions or global conspiracies are our neighbors, right? The people around us that you see on a day-to-day basis and make up your community. Those are your greatest responsibility, to make sure you're taking care of, you know, the people in your life. And we're told next issue we'll get Miles Morales's day off. And the last thing that I'll mention is that the art in this issue is really good. It's a little cartoony, but it totally suits kind of a younger type Spider-Man. And there's little nods here and there to Spider-Man things in the past, including on the ground next to Spider-Man's girlfriend's nephew is a box of popcorn, and it says Steve and Stan popcorn on the box. So that's a little nod to Steve Ditko and Stan Lee, you know, the original Spider-Man creative team. So I think that Saladin Ahmed's Miles Morales run on, you know, this Miles Morales series of Spider-Man gets better as it goes along. I do sort of feel like these first couple issues, he's sort of feeling it out. They're not as tightly plotted, or the dialogue isn't quite as good as it becomes later on. I mentioned that sort of clunky moment with Cap and Miles right in the middle. But it's been a popular series since it came out. It's selling pretty well. So I think Miles Morales, a lot of people really like him as Spider-Man. And like I said, it does harken back to the classic era of Spider-Man from Steve Ditko and Stan Lee that I just mentioned. You know, Peter Parker in high school juggling all these responsibilities, and now Miles is doing the same thing, but in the modern world. So are you a big Miles fan, Jay?
No, not really. I guess I'm old school. I mean, I understand they try to do like a reboot with the new generation and reach the new readers. I got that, but I'm kind of older now. So I'm kind of following Peter and his adventures. You know, he's not a kid anymore. So I guess that's why I like the story, but this story was pretty good. I mean, I've read his books here, Miles off and on, you know, it wasn't bad. And the story was good. I liked the story a lot. I just thought the team was kind of funny with Rhino. It's like all characters, Rhino.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely different. I mean, I think part of the reason that I like the Miles version of Spider-Man as opposed to Peter Parker, it's like, there's been so many Peter Parker stories told. It's almost like, what's left for him to prove, what's something new and fresh. And I haven't been a big fan of what Nick Spencer's been doing, because I feel like since issue one of his latest series, he's been telling the Kindred story. We're 55 issues in, we're 4 years in, and he's still telling the Kindred story. I'm over Kindred. I'm done with Kindred. I'm tired of him. Move on. We get it. Kindred. He's Harry Osborn. He's a bad guy. Okay. Can you tell another story like that? So I'm glad that I have the Miles Morales Spider-Man book every month to give me something other than Kindred. So,
well, I did laugh when I saw like the bad guy Snatcher. Cause I first saw it, I was like, I had to like look at it again. I was like, I think I know that guy. Cause yeah, you should meet people like that in the military like, all the time. So I'm like,
You know, and the thing is like, so this came out in 2017. So, you know, certainly after the 2016 election, where, you know, there were a lot of people politically in the U.S. emboldened, people like this Snatcher guy that believe those things, that were emboldened by the presidential administration at that time. But it's even worse now reading it in 2020, 2021, after, you know, the debacle of 2020 and the election and all that garbage. It makes it even worse. I have even less tolerance. Like, I don't think in this current environment, this current political environment, that Saladin Ahmed would have made a character like that. It's too on the nose, you know.
Oh yeah, I think we're talking about his last time. It's like, I get very tired of political stuff. I don't want to see in the comics. It's like, I see it every day. I see it on the news. I see it in the street. I see it in the paper. It's like, I'm just kind of over it. Just, you know, leave comics fun. Let's just your escape. And like for me, like, so when I was in the military and I always got my comics every month that, you know, came in a big ass box, I was excited because that was my escape from what I was over there. I mean, you know, this is, but to see it in the comic, you're like, oh, please no more. And then when you see comics that, you know, idolize politicians, you're like, why are you doing that?
Yeah.
It's like,
I mean, I get it. You're a writer and you're a person and you can't help but have your politics show up in comics. And I was just talking to Manny about this the other day. There's going to be like, we're going to look back on probably the period of comics from about late 2016, through, I don't know, 2021 through this year, maybe 2022. Like, say it's like the year, like 2035 or 2040, we're going to look back at this period and we're going to see that a lot of the villains in comics are going to be fascists because that's just what we're dealing with now. Just like if you go back and look at a lot of the comics that came out in World War II, who were they fighting? Well, they were fighting Nazis. You know, it's just because that's who the villains were in real life.
Right.
And so, you know, people, storytellers, they write what they know. So it's going to be, that's just going to be the reality. Now, that being said, I'll say it again, that I don't think Saladin Ahmed creates such a two-dimensional, on-the-nose, clear, right-wing fascist villain called the Snatcher, in 2020. It wasn't as bad in 2016 when he wrote this, so he could, you know, kind of get away with it. But yeah, nowadays, he definitely wouldn't. So.
Oh, yeah. Like I said, if you read old comics real quick, like in the Spider-Man and Avengers back in like from 66 to 73, you'll see a lot about the Vietnam War and how, you know, if you're over 30, I can't trust you type of mentality. Yep. It was in the books. And I was reading it and I was like, man, there was a lot of hate going on back that time.
Yeah, they're fighting communists, you know, especially in the Captain America books. Yeah, because that's what was going on in the country at the time.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's move on. Let's talk about Avengers No Road Home number 2. This is the weekly series written by Al Ewing, Jim Zub, and Mark Waid. Pencils are by Paco Medina. Inks are by Juan Velasco. Colors by Jesus Arbatov. And letters by Corey Petit. So we saw last issue that Voyager basically went around and recruited Avengers to fight against Nyx, who is this evil goddess. And she went around and slaughtered all the Olympian gods, and Scarlet Witch inadvertently said her name, and that sort of summoned her back to the location where she slew all the gods, Mount Olympus. And that's where this issue sort of takes off or starts off. Well, actually, I take that back. It starts off with a flashback where we see Voyager. She's guarding the Challenger who had challenged her father, the Grandmaster, in the, you know, to a battle or whatever you want to call it, a game, a challenge. And that's how the Earth got sort of kidnapped, planet napped, I guess, in the first weekly series, No Surrender. But this is kind of the follow-up on, and Jay and I were talking about how this one hasn't been as good. They were trying to catch lightning in a bottle again with the same creative team, and it just, no, the story is just not as interesting to me. So I think that's why it didn't work. But anyway, Voyager, or Vani Gast is her civilian identity, if you want to call it that. And she's not only watching him, but she's kind of just keeping an eye on things, as it were. And she sees this Nyx show up with her minions. And she sees Nyx and her minions basically slaughter all the gods of Olympus. What we're not told is why. Like, why did she come back? Why was she resurrected? But we do see her kill all these Olympian gods, including Zeus himself. And so she knows she needs to do something. She is even goaded by the Challenger. I guess the Challenger wants to be unguarded, even though he's sort of imprisoned, but he sort of goads her on by basically suggesting that the way Nyx got free had to do with what Challenger and her father did by removing the Earth from its proper place in the solar system, that could be how Nyx came back. Because supposedly Nyx wasn't supposed to be imprisoned until the sun stopped shining. So, I mean, the sun didn't stop shining, but maybe if the Earth was moved, then, you know, by the letter of the law or the letter of the curse or whatever, technically the sun wasn't shining on the Earth anymore, so she was able to escape. At least that's how the Challenger sort of presents it to Voyager, so she feels responsible, you know, to her, because of what her dad did and the fight and what have you, and her part that she played in that before she changed teams and became a good guy. And so the Challenger basically, you know, encourages her to go assemble the Avengers again and to fight off Nyx. And so once we're done with that flashback, then the scene goes back to Mount Olympus, and Scarlet Witch has been blinded by Nyx putting her hand through the back of Scarlet Witch's skull with her fingers coming out of her eyes. And so the rest of the heroes immediately start attacking. They do the best they can, but Nyx's other allies show up, and there's somewhat of a pitched battle. But eventually the Avengers are able to get a couple of shots in, but before they can sort of finish, Voyager transports them away. She's like, the whole reason that Nyx is having us fight here, she's goading us, it's a distraction. And if her children aren't here, they must have been sent out to retrieve the shards, the rest of the shards of her soul. So apparently Nyx is not up to full power yet, which is a scary thought when you think about how dangerous she's been. She's killed all the gods of Olympus. And Voyager even says, now that I can see her power and I can sense the location of the rest of the shards, we must go and intercept those shards before her minions can collect them all. And then she'll be too powerful for us to stop. So she sort of transports everybody away, and they wake up in places that you don't necessarily expect, right? So Clint Barton wakes up in a hospital bed and he's missing some of his fingers, and he's thinking to himself about how he's been lucky all this time. He's not really a hero, and how could he have even survived this long when he doesn't have any superpowers and all the people he's fought, he should have died a long time ago. And I mean, I almost feel like this issue is like Clint Barton's spotlight on who he is and his sort of feelings of inadequacy and self-doubt and what have you. And as he's lying there in bed, who shows up but Immortal Hulk, right? Who we saw in issue one is looking to get even with Barton for killing Banner, even though it was Banner's choice to do that, you know, to have that done. So that's where the issue ends, with the Hulk showing up there in Barton's hospital room saying, guess what, Barton, you're not alone. Time to settle up. So then we do get one more page called The Assembly, which gives us a rundown on who Nyx is, as well as her children. There's twins Apate, also known as Deceit, and Dolos, also known as Trickery. So it gives us a description of what they look like, as well as what their powers are. Then there's also a description of Nyx and her powers. Nyx meaning night. She has the power of shadow. And then Hypnos, which is sleep. And then Oisis, which is misery, who's like the snake-like creature who basically just makes people really sad and depressed and be completely consumed with self-doubt. So it's a little bit of almost a official Marvel handbook entry for these characters, giving us a little insight into who they are. So I mentioned this not being as good. So this book does something that I really, really dislike. And for me, it's what made this issue really subpar. You're almost forced to read this book twice, because this whole entire book is narrated by, most of the book is narrated by Clint Barton, by Hawkeye. Even the flashback scenes, there's these purple dialogue boxes or purple exposition boxes where Clint is basically speaking in the third person, talking to us, and giving us this narrative while we're also seeing events play out, you know, in the flashback and then in real time. The problem is you can't really keep track of Clint, what Clint is saying and Clint's train of thought, if in between reading the purple exposition boxes, you're reading the action and what else is going on. Like it doesn't, because sometimes you'll go a whole page and there's only one little box that's the completion of a sentence from the previous page. And by the time you get to that one little box and you've read all this other stuff that's happening in the meantime, you forget, like, wait, what was the first half of that sentence? So it can work if it's done really tightly. This is not done well. And so you've got to almost read it twice. You've got to like read it for the scenes and the action that's actually happening. And those balloon, you know, word balloons and what the people are actually saying that are showing up on the page. And then you've got to just go back through and read just the purple boxes to see what Clint is talking about. And sometimes they'll comics and will start out this way for a page or two, but this goes through the whole thing, including with Clint being in the hospital bed, you know, having lost some fingers and clearly not going to be able to be an archer going forward. And there's the one page after he realizes that where we've got just tons and tons and tons of dialogue boxes with a really bad joke that's supposed to make us feel bad for Clint Barton. So I get it. Yeah, he doesn't have superpowers, but this isn't the Clint that I like to read about. You know, I prefer to read about the Clint who doesn't really have that much introspection. You know, he doesn't. He believes in himself. He has confidence. He's trained by, you know, the best people in the world, including Captain America, to fight. And he doesn't question. Clint's not a big thinker, you know, and that's what allows him to do what he does. Because if you do this sort of thing with him as a character, then you're right. Like, what the hell is he doing on the team? He has no business being there. It doesn't make any sense. You know, I mean, think about the power level that Clint has versus the power level that the Hulk has. It doesn't make sense for him to be there. So he's not a character that can spend a lot of time analyzing that because it just doesn't work. So unfortunately, I think this issue doesn't work for exactly that reason and the reasons of having basically, you basically have two narratives happening simultaneously and you got to focus on one or the other. You can't focus on both. If you try to focus on both, you just get lost. So I don't know. Maybe it's just me. What did you think, Jay? Did that bother you at all? Did you even notice it?
Oh, you're talking about the watered down version of Hawkeye?
Yeah, yeah. Just
no, I didn't like it at all, guys. That's not the Hawkeye I know. It's like what? It made him kind of weak. I mean, think about it. He's not the only like normal person on the team. I mean, you have other members that are the same way. So he's doing it for how many years? And now all of a sudden he feels like he's not adequate. I mean, come on. Didn't feel right. And when I got to the last of this, when it first came out, I got to the last panel where it like explained all the main villains and her kids and what they did and everything. I was like, well, okay, it makes more sense. I went back and read the first one because it made more sense of what, you know, what was going on, which is kind of weird because I was like, I never really did that before.
Yeah. I mean, think about other, you mentioned other characters don't have superpowers. Technically, Batman has no superpowers. Batman would never be laying around going, oh, I shouldn't be here. I'm only here because I'm lucky. No, you're here because you trained your whole life to be here and you have worth.
Well, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you got Black Widow. I mean, she's an Avenger. She's just a spy.
Yeah. I mean, she has her Widow Blast, but those come from the little bracelets that she wears. Right.
Right. And even Iron Man, I mean, he, without the suit, he's just a guy, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, I'm not feeling that one, guys. Wade and Zub and Ewing didn't like that. All right, well, let's move on. Doctor Strange number 11. This is from the aforementioned Mark Waid as writer. We have Jesus Saez with Javier Pina as listed as artist, color artist Jesus Saez and Rochelle Rosenberg, and letters by Corey Petit. And we saw at the end of the last issue, issue 10, which was also Legacy issue 400, that the Faultine had showed up to Earth. Doctor Strange had been had sort of this confrontation with the accountants of magic, I guess you'd say, where he had used all this magic and he hadn't paid the price and they took his powers away. And so now they've sent him back to Earth. And Dormammu is there with the rest of the Faultine and they're basically wreaking havoc. And so Strange knows that their odds are long. They're not in good shape to fight off this invasion. Certainly his three sort of, I guess you'd call them students, are not in any sort of shape. They don't have the power or the abilities to stop Dormammu or the Faultine. So he actually uses a spell to transport them away. He's hoping that his allies, Zelma, Kanna, and Wong, can find something to help them, something specific to help them against this Faultine invasion on Earth. So he actually sends them back to the accountant's office, like the head accountant that had taken the powers away. And they're trying to figure out when they first get there, so why did he send us back here? What are we supposed to be doing? So they start searching around for something that'll help. Meanwhile, back on Earth, most of the Faultine are just laying havoc to New York. They're just lighting fires and destroying buildings. And Doctor Strange is trying to stall for time to give his allies time to find a way to defeat the Faultine, because Doctor Strange is tired. You know, he's limited on his magic. He knows that, you know, the reckoning from these accountants, that part is not over. He still owes a big debt. And he does at one point, you know, fire a magical bolt at Dormammu, who just blocks it with his hand. And Strange even says, "I'm tired, man." And once Dormammu realizes that and he goes on the offensive, "I'm dead. So I need to keep him talking." So we learn a little bit about how Dormammu sees the rest of his race. Most of them are the equivalent of clones. That's how the Faultine sort of procreate. And they just sort of, you know, split off. One is just a copy of another, is a copy of another, is a copy of another. And that's the case for all of them except for Dormammu and his sister Umar, who are more powerful because they are individual. And so Strange has him talking about that and how... and for that reason, like, why do you want to see them succeed? And Dormammu is talking about how he hopes to punish Strange. And so Strange is doing a good job of keeping him talking, basically. Dormammu is doing his best Bond villain imitation, as it were. And Strange even asked him at one point, if you have such contempt for the rest of your race, why do you even care what they rule? And he's like, well, it's kind of because if they rule this planet, it's going to cause you a lot of pain. So, you know, a lot of it has to do with me just wanting to punish you, Dr. Strange. And I haven't even decided what I'm going to do with you, but I'm thinking I might just leave you to wander Earth for all eternity. Given that there's going to be nothing left of Earth except for a smoldering graveyard. So meanwhile, back at the accountant's office, the three allies have found what they were looking for. Basically, they found the part of the Ancient One's brain that got taken out. The accountants were punishing Strange and trying to collect debt from Strange by punishing his allies. And the way they did that with the Ancient One is they cut out the portion of his brain that contained all the magic that the Ancient One had accumulated over his extremely long lifetime. So they figure this is exactly the reason Strange sent us here. We can basically learn all this magic. It'll be like you have three Ancient Ones. But the problem is when you learn magic like that, when magic teachings are stolen rather than learned, they're toxic. And when you use them, the user experiences pain and eventually it will cause death. But that's for the long term. In the short term, they've gained this knowledge. They've come back to Earth to help Doctor Strange fight off the Faultine. So it works pretty well. They're able to fight them all off, or at least temporarily. And then all four allies all surround Dormammu, and they're using all their power together. If they combine all their might, they'll be able to defeat Dormammu. But unfortunately, the amount of power that the other three that basically stole the Ancient One's knowledge, the amount of power they're using is causing them to be poisoned by that stolen knowledge even faster. So Strange can see them in pain. And he calls out to them, "I know you're in pain. We're almost there. Keep concentrating. I know the Ancient One's knowledge is poisoning you, but you got to fight it off and fight through it. A few more seconds and we'll have defeated Dormammu." But just as they're about to do that, they all start basically passing out. And so Strange has to pull the knowledge out of them, says, "Knowledge be gone." He has to, or they're all going to die. He could have chosen to sacrifice all of them and defeat Dormammu for good, but he's Doctor Strange. These are his friends. These are his allies. And he chooses to spare them, which allows Dormammu to recover and basically blast all them back with a force beam. And as Strange is there on his knees in front of Dormammu, he says, "Once again, your mercy is your liability. You made an excellent point about the fall team. I hadn't considered that. Thank you." And he's referring to, you know, when he was asking if you dislike the fall team so much, you know, why are you helping them? If everything goes according to your plan, then they win, basically. You are always trying to prove your superiority over the fall team once and for all. But if you allow them to conquer Earth like you've never been able to do, aren't you doing the exact opposite of what you always wanted to do? Like, because remember, Dormammu and sees himself as better than the rest of the fall team because he's an individual and he thinks for himself and he's not just a copy of a copy of a copy. And he wants to prove that he's the best of all the fall team. But if he lets the Faltine destroy the Earth, something Dormammu himself wasn't able to do, doesn't that kind of defeat the purpose? So anyway, it's an interesting like thought experiment. And it's how Strange was able to distract Dormammu and have all his allies come and attack him. But again, you know, at the last minute, they're all being poisoned by the power. And, you know, Dormammu's about to destroy Doctor Strange once and for all. You know, he says, like I mentioned, yeah, excellent point. Hadn't considered that. But provided your lackeys have weakened the Faltine, I can destroy them and you and this realm and, you know, rule over all. I win, basically. And he starts charging up his hand to deal the fatal blow to Doctor Strange when he's blasted from behind by another magical bolt. And we see that it's the Ancient One saying, "Not today, foul demon." And basically, he has all his knowledge back. He's hale and hearty as much as an Ancient One ever is. So when Doctor Strange removed the knowledge and made all the rest of his allies forget all the knowledge that they had gained from the Ancient One, it all went flooding back into him. It was no longer trapped and held in that pocket accountant realm or dimension or whatever it is. So Ancient One helps Doctor Strange back to his feet, saying, you know, "Thanks for returning my knowledge to me. Please don't listen to your enemy. Mercy is your strength." And he uses some spells to basically help heal and help the allies recover and get back on their feet. Meanwhile, Dormammu has faded away with the rest of the Faltine back to the hellscape they all call home. And later at the Sanctum Sanctorum, the allies are sitting together, sort of rehashing what went on. And everybody's saying they're recovered, except for a slight headache from having the knowledge of the Ancient One. And what's her name? The librarian of the group, she says to the Ancient One, "Yeah, it was great to have all your knowledge, you know, for a short period of time. You know so much, and it you know, it could have been lost." And so the Ancient One even says, like, "Well, would you like to travel with me and be my librarian? I know so many spells that I'm the only one who knows them. And, you know, when I die, I worry that knowledge will be lost." Zelma, that's her name. And so she's over the moon with that idea. You know, this is a girl who loves to learn and loves to catalog things and loves, I mean, she's a librarian at heart. So Dr. Strange, you know, thinks it's a great idea as well, knows that it has to be a dream come true for Zelma to go and, you know, catalog and accompany the Ancient One on his travels and help create a library. So Wong leaves as well, off to other places, I guess. It doesn't really talk about him. But then Kanna, the alien who Strange traveled with for a long time in outer space as he was going around gathering new magical powers. Strange says, "You know, there's a portal in my study and it'll take you wherever you like, but I hope you decide to stay here. We work well together and there were no secrets this time out." And the whole animosity there has to do with Strange basically straight up lying to Kenna at one point, you know, agreeing that they were going to go and get one of the Infinity Gems. I think it was the Time Gem, that they needed to go and capture it from a Skrull that had it. And Kenna was like, well, what's in it for me? And Strange basically promised her that they'd capture the Time Gem and then he would let her have it. But then he actually makes her forget that they even went out after they retrieved the Time Gem. He makes her forget that they even knew about the Time Gem. And when she finds out that he lied, and basically he's like, it's too dangerous to be in anybody's hands. But then she doesn't trust him anymore. She's like, well, you should have told me that. You know, you should have just appealed to my better nature instead of saying you were going to give it to me, promising you were going to give it to me, and then lying about it. So again, Strange is trying to patch that up and says, you know, no secrets. And what do you think? He holds out her hand and she turns her back on his hand and says, you know what? I think it's a step in the right direction, but keep walking and maybe you'll find your way back to me someday. I hope so. And she leaves. And we're told next issue, Galactus. So looking forward to that. But yeah, this continues to be a really, really great series. I love the idea of magic having a price, which it's always had a price, but never so tangential. You know, it's always been something to pay off in the future. And it's not like that's been resolved, right? It's not like, I mean, maybe you would consider the damage that the Faultine did to Earth some measure of payment. But Strange still has to have a huge debt. So I imagine that's going to continue hanging over his head at some point. So what'd you think of this issue? Jay, I know that you hadn't really been reading Strange until Dr. Strange, until we started covering it.
Oh yeah. I'm more invested in the series because of this. The artwork is really good. Like I said, I didn't know it was that good. I didn't know the storyline was that good. And like I said last time, it's whenever I saw Strange, it was always kind of a pompous person. I'm like, but this one makes him seem more likable, I guess, reading, you know, the storyline.
Well, yeah, that's another thing that's interesting to point out. We're talking about the debt that Strange owes it, and the fact that he's kind of ignoring it. It's showing weakness, because you're right. Before, he's always been pompous and like super powerful, and how did he ever lose? And creating this inherent weakness in him makes him more relatable, and seeing him make a mistake, you know, do something so bad. I mean, there's no other way to put it. Like lying to Kenna the way he did, like straight up, just, I promise you can have it. Not even giving her the chance to do the right thing, making that decision for her and see that she's not willing to let it go. You know, that's not usually the way Strange is portrayed. He's sort of portrayed as this all knowing, all powerful sort of character that you never question. And all he has to do to solve a problem is wave his hand. Well, he can't wave his hand and fix what he did with Kenna. He can't wave his hand and make all his debt go away. So I think it brings an interesting aspect and makes him a lot more interesting character.
Right. And like I said, it leaves you with like kind of a cliffhanger. It's like, okay, so is she done with him? Or you got Galactus coming, but you know the debt's still there. So it's like, okay, what's going to happen to the debt now?
Yeah, exactly. And I agree with you on the art. I didn't mention it. So it's not just the line work by Saez, but the color work by Jesus Arbatov is done really well, especially because the majority of the issue, it takes place on a rooftop in New York City with the Faultine burning the city down around them. So everything has kind of this orange glow around it because the city's on fire and it's burning. And Arbatov does a really great job of giving everything that sort of inherent glow, like everything is on fire, everything's burning. So great job. All right, up next, let's talk about Guardians of the Galaxy number 2. This is the Donny Cates version of Guardians with art by Jeff Shaw, who's his collaborator on the cover series, or not cover, crossover rather, from Image. Colors here by Marte Garcia, letters by Corey Petit. And just to catch everybody up, Gamora supposedly killed Thanos and almost destroyed the universe with the Infinity Gems. And in the aftermath, the Guardians were no more. In fact, Gamora basically stabbed Peter Quill through the chest. He's still trying to come to terms with such a good and trusted ally stabbing him through the chest. So she's on the run. Drax is dead. Nobody knows where Rocket Raccoon is. And this big group of cosmic characters in the Marvel Universe, sort of gathered together by Star Fox, or Eros, Thanos's brother were all together on Galactus's ship, Sanctuary, reading, or not Galactus's ship, but Thanos's ship, reading Thanos's will. And Thanos's body was there, but not his head. And they were, as I said, reading Galactus's will. And in the will, Galactus basically says, why do I keep saying Galactus? Thanos. They're reading Thanos's will on Thanos's ship because Gamora has killed her father, Thanos. So Eros has brought all of them together. Eros has already seen Thanos's will. He puts out a call to get all these different cosmic characters from the Marvel Universe together so they can all watch Thanos's will because it's like a holographic recording. And when Thanos gives his will, that gives his message, what he says is, I'm Thanos. I plan for everything. And I, you know, at some point I thought I might actually really die, but I set it up so that my consciousness would be transferred into another person's body upon my death. And so the reason that Eros or Star Fox has gathered everybody together is because they need to figure out who Thanos is. They like the galaxy a lot better without Thanos in it. So they need to go and stop whoever Thanos is in this new body. And we got a double page spread of various people that it could be. And some of them made no sense at all. Like Thanos is not going to take over Kamala Khan or Daredevil or there was one other one that was like the Invisible Woman, I think was another one that was just like, I don't think Thanos is going to do that. Take over somebody like Thor, Jean Grey. Yeah. You could see that. But yeah, for most of those people, no. But anyway, while they're reading Thanos' will, the Black Order attack. They nearly wipe out all those cosmic characters. They steal Thanos' body, and they send the rest of the survivors into a black hole. And we find out the Black Order are working under orders from Hela, who is the Asgardian goddess of death and was Thanos' ally. Most recently. So meanwhile, Peter Quill and Groot, the last two remaining members of the Guardians of the Galaxy, show up at the site of the fight between the Black Order and these other cosmic characters at the last moment. And Beta Ray Bill is able to throw Stormbreaker out of the black hole. And around Stormbreaker is wrapped the chains of the Cosmic Ghost Rider. And he basically throws Stormbreaker. It crashes into the Rider, which is the ship that Star-Lord, or Peter Quill, and Groot are currently piloting, and they basically tow them out of the black hole with Beta Ray Bill holding on to the chain, Cosmic Ghost Rider's holding on, Phyla Vell is holding on, so is Moondragon. We saw a few other people get sucked in, but we don't see what happens to them, particularly Silver Surfer is unaccounted for. So they pull them aboard the ship, and then at the last second, the Nova Corps show up, and they want to take all those characters into custody. They want to ask them some questions. And Star-Lord's like, you're not taking them anywhere. Like, they're on my ship. You need a warrant to take them. And the Nova Corps is like, well, not if they're not your crew. He says, no, they are my crew. This is the new Guardians of the Galaxy. So that's how it ends. So new version of the Guardians of the Galaxy here. Two old members, Star-Lord and Groot, but they're filled out now by Moondragon, Phyla Vell, Beta Ray Bill, and Cosmic Ghost Rider. So that's where this issue starts off. And it starts off with Peter Quill basically giving sort of a recap, talking about how Thanos is dead, how Gamora tried to kill him. And it looks like he's just talking, you know, straight to us through the page, but who he's actually talking to is Kitty Pryde. And she's like, man, you look like crap. You know, there are such things as showers in space. I know times are hard, but you know, you need to do better. And he's like, whatever. I'm doing the best I can. Sorry, I missed the wedding. And she's like, Peter, why are you calling me? He's like, I don't know. I guess I needed someone to talk to who wasn't a tree or a horse or a demon or a bunch of cops, I guess. And she's like, no, what I mean is, why are you calling me and not her? He's like, what her? What do you mean? And she's like, you know what? Never mind. She's talking about Gamora, of course. Like, why aren't you talking to her? She's the one you should be talking to. And really the reason is because she tried to kill him and he's not over that. He doesn't understand that, like why that happened. So meanwhile, the scene shifts and we see the Collector getting the crap beat out of him by the Black Order, along with Hela, and they're, you know, the collector's pretty much locked into anything black market that goes on in the Marvel Universe, and they're trying to track down Thanos's head. The only other thing that I'll say about this is I sort of, again, just not to beat a dead horse, but now for whatever reason, well, and we know why, the collector never looked like Benicio del Toro before. He had his own unique look, and it was fine. It was a cool comic book look. I don't know why, just because Benicio del Toro played him in the film, now we got to draw the collector like Benicio del Toro. Just draw him the way you used to draw him. There's no need for this. He probably won't ever show up in another MCU movie again. I just hate it that they have to do that. Like, no, just draw the collector the way he's supposed to be drawn rather than drawing Benicio del Toro. It bugs the crap out of me. But anyway, he's pretty defiant, the collector is, or Benicio. I'm gonna just call him Benicio. Benicio's pretty defiant and not going to tell them anything until Hela shows up. And then he's like, oh, crap, Hela. Yeah, I heard you recently regained control of Hell. And he doesn't want to give up the information, and she's kind of pressing him. And he says, well, yeah, maybe I should just go ahead. I mean, she kind of read between the lines sort of thing. Maybe I should go ahead and just tell you, because if not, you might kill me. And supposedly the elders of the universe have a deal with death so that they're immortal. But Hela even says, you know, you boys pledge allegiance to that pathetic woman. But nevertheless, here's my offer to you. You tell me where Thanos's head is, and I won't show you how easy it is to have death break those deals. So she's literally threatening his life, even though supposedly he's immortal. And I guess Benicio figures, well, better to not take a chance, and better to just, you know, get the crazy Hell chick out of my face. And so he says, okay, I hear the negative zone is quite lovely this time of year. So apparently that's where Thanos's head is. Meanwhile, back on the Rider, the ship of the Guardians of the Galaxy, we see Moondragon and Phyla Vell trying to recover from their ordeal of being sucked into a black hole. We see some of the other new members of the Guardians of the Galaxy aren't getting along very well. Namely, Groot and Cosmic Ghost Rider are having a knockdown, drag-out brawl, basically because Cosmic Ghost Rider wants to go after Gamora. That is, in Star Fox's opinion, the most obvious vessel for Thanos' consciousness. And so Ghost Rider wants to go and hunt her down and kill her and basically continue to follow the plan that Star Fox had laid out, whereas Groot remains loyal to his former teammate. So Quill's not having any of it. He's like, look, we're not on anybody's side. We're not going to go after Gamora. We're not going to go after Gamora. If that's what you guys want to do, you know where the door is. But all I care about is, you know, getting some sleep. And we find out as Quill leaves the room, Groot kind of follows him. And he says, look, the demon's going to go after Gamora. We need to do something to stop him. And Peter Quill's like, no, we don't. You and I are the only people in the cosmos who even know where she is, and they'll never look for her there. Besides, you can't kill someone who's already dead. So I think Quill's saying that she's dead to them, you know, based on the fact that she tried to kill him. Where she is, you know, we still don't have any idea, but they clearly know. But he's not about to go rushing in trying to save her. He really is struggling with the fact that she tried to stab him. Meanwhile, later on a Royal Shi'ar destroyer, we see Gladiator is talking to Star Fox. So apparently he survived the whole black hole ordeal too, but he was wounded. He looks kind of like Two-Face now, with half his face all scarred up, which I don't really understand, because he's a Titan and they're supposed to have really, really great healing abilities. So why is he not healing? And he's even in this like Charles Xavier, like floating wheelchair, like he can't walk. And I why would that be? He's supposed to have the ability to heal. So what is it about this black hole that caused him all this damage? But anyway, he is continuing with his plan. He's called together his own group. We've got Gladiator. We've got a Kree soldier. We've got Black Knight. We've got the Cosmic Ghost Rider having now joined him. And he's saying, we will guard this galaxy. We will go after Gamora by any means necessary. Wraith is there. as well. And so they're still going to continue to search for Gamora and kill her. And Nebula is there as well. And when Star Fox asks if Nebula will have any problem killing her sister, she says no. And their plan is to contact Richard Rider, because apparently that's who Gamora really loves, and he'll always know where she is. So it's an interesting story. I like where we're going here. I like the idea of Thanos sort of pulling people's strings, even from beyond the veil when he's dead. But I do have a couple issues with it. First, this is no characterization of Star Fox that I've ever seen. And I get that maybe you want to show that he's been kind of pushed over the edge to act out of character because he finally thought that the universe was rid of Thanos, and they're not. And so he wants to complete that, but it's so wildly out of character. It just doesn't feel like Star Fox. He feels like the wrong character. I feel like in a way, Donny Cates is ruining Star Fox as a character. He's doing a total heel turn here, and it's not working for me. The other part I have a problem with is, yeah, all the damage. Like, again, you should have just used a different character. You could have just used some random person from Titan, you know, that had a grudge against Thanos and was happy he was dead, and you know, had him act like this, because between the damage and the physical changes and the way he acts, I like Star Fox. He's a cool character, and I feel like you're ruining him here. So whether or not that's the case and whether or not he can be redeemed, I don't know. I don't like the way Cates is writing Star Fox. The rest of it, I'm kind of like, whatever. It's sort of an interesting take. But yeah, I'm having a real hard time with the Star Fox thing. The art's pretty solid. It's not the cleanest line work in the world. It is great to see a lot of these cosmic characters that we don't get to see a lot of, like Beta Ray Bill and Wraith and some of these others. Usually it's good to see Star Fox, but it's not good to see him here. And I really hate Cosmic Ghost Rider as a character. Again, another Donny Cates thing that just doesn't work for me. And don't get me wrong, I think Donny Cates is a super, super talented writer, has really great ideas. He's very passionate about them. He goes all in on his ideas, which I respect him for doing that. But some of his ideas I just plain don't like. And so I don't read that stuff. And I tried to read Cosmic Ghost Rider. I read the first three issues, maybe the first two issues, and I just couldn't do it. I had to drop it. It was awful. It was so bad. So, like I said, it is great to see some of these characters, and a lot of their characterizations are interesting, but I'm just not interested in what he's doing to Star Fox. So I'm sort of torn on this, because I am a fan of Thanos. And I do kind of, I'm interested in what's going to happen here, but man, I don't know that I'll read more just based on the characterization of Star Fox. Rather, I hate to see him ruined as a character. Have you read this whole series, Jay?
Yeah, I did. Believe it or not, I was actually a fan of the Guardian of the Galaxy when the 1990 series came out. I know that's not the original one, but
yeah,
I picked that up. I was like, well, it should be pretty good. I stuck with it for, 70 issues? It wasn't the greatest, but when they actually redid it again with these characters, I was like, okay, it's a little bit better, you know? But this series here is it's a little different, like you said, and I was just going to see where they're going with it. I read it. I was like, okay, let's see where they're taking the characters, you know, because now we got a new team and, you know, I guess someone is stabbing somebody, and it's like, all right, so you pretty much got a new Guardians of the Galaxy team, which I guess they needed to change it after so many years.
Yeah, it is interesting. You know, Guardians, when people hear Guardians of the Galaxy, they expect a certain level of humor, and I didn't talk about any of the humorous moments because they're sprinkled in here or there, but they're not. It doesn't drive the narrative the way it did in the old Guardians, you know, and the way it does in the movie, where there's constant jokes that get called back to. The jokes here are just sort of one and done kind of things, like the way Frank Castle and Peter Quill, you know, the Cosmic Ghost Rider and Peter Quill, like the way they interact, you know, they're funny moments, but they're not anything that like I said, that drives the story or that you're going to remember, you know. But it is, I'll give Donny Cates credit for at least trying to make sure there's some humor in it. But again, it's just like, how memorable is it going to be? And probably that interaction between Peter Quill and Frank Castle is the funniest part, right? Like Frank Castle has been transformed back into his human form by Moondragon, and Peter Quill walks up to him and goes, you know, what's your problem? Who the hell even are you? And he says, Frank Castle, Ghost Rider, Herald of Galactus. It's a whole alternate future thing. He goes, yeah, that tracks. I don't like any of those things. Like, I'm right there with you, Peter. I don't like Frank Castle. I don't like Ghost Rider. I don't like Herald of Galactus. Like, just, yeah, he's just a character that in my mind shouldn't exist. Like, I don't know why Kate's created him. He's just, I mean, I guess you just think of, okay, who's the most least likely cosmic character in the entire history of the Marvel Universe? And I'll make them the Herald of Galactus. It's just dumb. I think the only least likely person to be a Herald of Galactus would be Aunt May. It's the only way he could have done anything worse than Frank Castle. So,
no, I agree. It was a terrible character. It's like, just keep Johnny as hell. You know, that'd be fine. But why did you do it this way? I mean, you could have went a different route, but I don't know. I just think they could have went a totally different route with that storyline.
Yeah, but again, Cates is a super popular writer, and that he has a loyal following that will just buy anything that he writes. And that's great. That's great. I mean, by all means, if you're buying comics, buy what you like, read what you like. But you can't tell me just because it has a certain writer's name on it that it's good. Nobody produces 100% good content. It just doesn't happen.
Oh yeah, Stephen King.
Yeah, exactly. All right, well, let's move on to the last book. It's Daredevil number 23. Not much happens in this issue, so I think it's going to go relatively quickly. But it's written by Charles Soule. The art in this one is by Alec Morgan. Colors by Matt Miller. Letters by Clayton Cowles. Just to remind everybody what happened. So Matt had won his first big victory by in court by convincing a judge to let Daredevil testify as Daredevil without revealing his secret identity. So basically what that means is it could set a precedent that would allow superheroes to testify without endangering themselves or any of their family, because nobody will know who they are. And they could, instead of just dropping criminals off at the local precinct or leaving them webbed up or tied up or what have you for the police, you know, you can wait for the cops. You can testify. You can make sure they get convicted. In Daredevil's case, you know, he's got his super hearing. He's like a human wiretap who doesn't need a warrant. He can just, you know, sit around and listen. When he hears something that's illegal, he can go report it, get up on the stand. Yes, I heard it. People trust him because he's Daredevil. Prisoner gets put away. Obviously, there are some people that aren't real happy about this. And we saw on the final page of the last issue that when Kingpin got word of it, he was really upset. So as we start Supreme Part 3, we see Daredevil, Kingpin, he's working out on a heavy bag. And he's saying, I know the law. I have to as much as any lawyer or cop because it's part of my work. And the law is just a bunch of boundary lines and it marks off their territory, but from my territory. And I know where I can go and where they can go. And I use that knowledge. I know the law. And because I do, I always have the same question for any lawyer who works for me. Why do I need you? And he's talking to this lawyer who's there, whose name is Legal. That's literally the lawyer's name. And he must repeat it about 20 times in the issue. I am Legal, Mr. Fisk. I do not need to justify my reputation, and neither do you. And so we learn that he used to be Tony Stark's lead attorney. He basically was Stark's entire in-house legal department for years. And Kingpin kind of presses him on it a little bit, and he goes, now let's speak of other things. I never discuss my former clients. I am Legal. And so we also see that there's a camera that's recording this conversation and recording this interaction. And in a room not too far away, Tombstone is watching all of this on camera. And he's like, why are you showing me this? And he says, well, isn't it obvious? You know, this is the Kingpin, and his plan to stop Matt Murdock in this case is this guy Legal, but your plan B. And what you need to be sure about is that you don't get caught. Basically, you're not left in the bag, as it were. So meanwhile, back in the workout room, Kingpin continues to punch the bag, where Legal kind of recaps what he sees as the case. And it's up to Kingpin to decide whether or not to hire legal. So ultimately he does. He says, okay, you're hired, and, you know, do the best you can. He's got plan B, so he's not too worried about it. Meanwhile, at a bar in Manhattan called the Lawyer Bar, Matt Murdock is sitting at a table with Jennifer Walters. They're both having a drink, and he is there to show Jennifer Walters his brief, because even though he won the case initially, or won the part of the case, he hasn't gotten the conviction for the Slugowski or whatever his name is, that Daredevil testified against, but he did win the part of the case that allowed Daredevil to testify. And that decision that the judge made has been appealed up the ladder to various Supreme Courts. And so far he's won every appeal, and the powers that be keep challenging, right? And he doesn't even know who's challenging at this point, but somebody's challenging the standing that Daredevil has the right to testify. So he's asking Jennifer Walters for her legal expertise. And she's like, yeah, this looks like pretty good stuff, but why are you sharing this with me? You know, I'm not even on the case. So he's like, well, no, but you're a good lawyer and you know superhero law. And she's like, well, that's true. But, you know, Foggy Nelson has worked with Daredevil more. And he says, I'm kind of taking a break from Foggy. It's like, well, what about Daredevil? Why didn't Daredevil talk to Foggy? Well, Daredevil's kind of taking a break from Foggy too. Like, and Matt says, yeah, it's kind of complicated. I don't really want to get into it if you don't mind. And then Matt says, and by the way, your voice sounds higher than usual. You're in your, you know, civilian form. Like, you're not hulked out. Cause you know, She-Hulk used to just walk around as She-Hulk all the time. He goes, I don't remember last time I saw you unhulked. What's going on? She goes, I don't really want to get into it if you don't mind. And Matt thinks, why did he even ask that? You know that you don't ask those kind of questions when you're a superhero. So Jennifer's concern is the fact that Matt is going up against legal, and the fact that he's such a great attorney, and they don't know who's hired him, right? Like, he's a really expensive lawyer, you know, like an all the way at the top lawyer. And so certainly the Slugowski guy wouldn't have hired him. So who is it that is pushing this, right? Who's trying to get this standing, this precedent thrown out to keep it from being set? So while they're sitting there talking about that and trying to figure out, and Jennifer even raises the question of whether or not they should be doing this, because what happens if they lose? And, you know, is Daredevil sure he wants to go down this path? And Matt's talking about, well, you know, this isn't just for Daredevil. It could work for, you know, any superhero that has a secret identity. And Jennifer's like, the superheroes even have secret identities before? He's like, yeah, look, Spider-Man, Miss Marvel, White Tiger, Iron Fist. She's like, well, those are all vigilantes. They're not real big on like the court system, right? Like, too big on procedure. Would they even want to testify? Have you talked to any of them about it? And Matt's argument is, well, look, every case is about the subsequent case, about what comes after. So if we can get this ruling, you know, basically in writing, if we can make this work, then it'll be there for anybody to use if they want it down the line. And Jennifer's just like, I'm not sure, you know, what you're trying to prove. You know, shouldn't you be more worried about the conviction, just making sure this terrorist goes to jail? So they're having this philosophical conversation and talking about the points of law and such. And I don't think they're necessarily reaching a consensus when Tombstone walks up. And we know this is plan B, and plan B is for Tombstone basically to kill Matt Murdock. So Matt can't really, you know, change into Daredevil right there, because that, you know, he'll lose his secret identity again. So he has to kind of put up with getting roughed up a little bit and thrown out the window. But once he's outside, now he'll maybe have the chance to turn into Daredevil. But what we do know is that Jen Walters is going to, even though she doesn't like to do it, doesn't like to turn into Hulk, she's going to turn into Hulk. And I'm not sure who over at Marvel decided this. One of the things I loved about Jen Walters, one of the things I loved about She-Hulk, was that she was so different than the Hulk, and that she retained her intelligence and she didn't look like a man. And I just don't understand. I don't know if it was Jason Aaron who writes her in Avengers or what, but I hate this version of She-Hulk. I've said it over and over and over. She's basically just a female version of the old childlike Hulk, you know, the old Hulk smash Hulk. She no longer maintains her intelligence. She's kind of savage, but she doesn't have a choice here. She hulks out. She beats the crap out of Tombstone, and now she's worried that she'll never be allowed back into the lawyer bar. Meanwhile, when Tombstone gets knocked out of the bar, he's out the window as well. So now Matt doesn't have time to change into Daredevil. He's still trying to figure out who hired Tombstone. And by the time She-Hulk gets out there and is about to kill literally kill Tombstone, Matt ends up having to protect him by distracting She-Hulk, and Tombstone runs off. So Jen changes back, and she tells Matt, "Well, you asked why I stay mostly like this. It's because it's not like it was before when I used to change into her. Like, I might have killed that guy if you hadn't distracted me. And lawyer bar, they're never going to let me back in there. So, you know, good luck with your case, Matt. I hope it goes well. And maybe it's too late to tell you this, but one thing I've learned recently, you know, I can turn into the Hulk anytime I want, but just because you can do something doesn't always mean you should." So again, I just hate, to me, they've ruined She-Hulk by doing this. They took away what made her unique and what made her fun and what made her a cool character. So 2 weeks later, we're in Albany, the capital of New York, at the New York State Court of Appeals, People versus Simon Slagowski. And we see legal there, and he's making his arguments, and Matt is looking on and thinking, you know, a question just occurred to me that I probably should have thought about earlier. I was so focused on getting ready for this hearing. And now that I'm here, I'm thinking back to what Jen said about who hired this guy, because Jen's right. This guy's a really good lawyer, and you know, he's got the judges hanging on every word he's saying. And you know, he's bringing up things that haven't been brought up before that maybe don't have much to do with our case, but you know, the judges, this is their kingdom, and they can rule and ask questions about anything they want. So this guy's so good, and somebody like Simon Slagowski wouldn't even have access, wouldn't even be ever in the same room with somebody like legal. So how the heck could this have been set up? There's got to be somebody else behind it. And what about the Tombstone angle? Why did he show up? Is that connected to this? What is actually happening here? And while he's thinking about all this, it comes his time to stand up in front of these judges and present his side of the case. And he thinks to himself, you know what? I got to focus on what's happening here. This is basically the biggest oral argument of my career. And so he stands up and he gets ready to make his argument. And that's when we get the to be continued. So just like I talked about when we talked about the last couple issues with Matt unleashing this plan, I love the fact that Charles Soule is integrating his knowledge and expertise as a lawyer to bring this sort of legal stuff into Daredevil. I mean, maybe some people don't care for it, but I find the law to be very fascinating. It can be dry sometimes for sure. But I love this kind of stuff. I like the fact that Charles Soule brought Jen Walters in, you know, and he wrote a She-Hulk series for a little while. It was, I think, 12 or 13 issues. He didn't get a chance to write her with the whole, she turns into the semi-savage Hulk or what have you. So I don't know how he felt about that, but he weaved it in expertly. And the whole line of her saying, you know, I can turn into the Hulk anytime I want, but just because you can do something doesn't mean you should. I mean, that was like the perfect allegory of what Matt is doing here, right? She's throwing it out there, telling him, hey, just because you could do this doesn't mean you necessarily should. I mean, she raised another great point. Like, have you talked to any of these other heroes that you're saying you're doing this for, right? Because it really seems like Matt's just doing it for himself. And we know that because he is Daredevil. Would Spider-Man want to testify? Would Kamala Khan want to testify? Would the rules be different for her because she's a minor? So yeah, it seems like Matt is just hell bent, and we know he can be obsessive, and he's hell bent on this idea. But like Jen said, just because you can do something doesn't mean you necessarily should. So yeah, really digging the story. It's really great to see, like I said, Charles Soule pulling in some of his expert legal knowledge. Probably the weakest part of this issue is the art by Alec Morgan. It's just not very good. I'm not familiar. I don't think I've ever seen Alec Morgan art before or since. And it's just not, yeah, it's just not very good. The faces are especially off-putting in a way. The line work's not particularly good. I think he tries to sort of tilt the camera here and there to vary the camera angles around, but even that is sort of lazy and doesn't really work. The transitions from panel to panel is probably the strength of his work. It definitely comes across as sequential art. But the line work and the aesthetic is just not very good. Anatomies is inconsistent. So yeah, didn't care for the artwork at all. And I think Matt Miller, the colorist, does the best he can with it. And it kind of works, but I would prefer not to see Alec Morgan art again on Daredevil. Maybe his stuff would work more in a horror genre or slice of life, but I don't think it works for superhero comic. So anyway, what are your thoughts? Any thoughts on the issue, Jay?
No, I liked it. Like I said, I've always said if the artwork is good or the story is good, you got me. And the story was good. The writing was good. So if the artwork wasn't, like I said, that clean, but I like how he made Legal like an albino, because he's the only one that actually was actually super white on everybody. I guess to show that, you know, you got to watch this guy. He's the one you got to look out for. And you're right. It's the Savage She-Hulk. It's like, no, I don't like it. I like the John Byrne version. Mm-hmm. I mean, those covers were phenomenal. And they still are today. They hold the value over the years. But it is cool to see him actually talking and doing lawyer talk. That was kind of fun because, you know, like, well, you know, she is a lawyer, so that made sense.
Yeah, it totally makes sense. And she focuses on superhero law, so it makes even more sense that way. But, I mean, usually they make changes like this to She-Hulk.
But she's hideous now.
Yeah, she's... But usually when they do make these kind of changes, you know, it's just to try to shake it up, the status quo, but they'll usually revert back.
Right.
Man, it's been...
Years.
5-6 years now.
Yeah, it's like, been a while.
It's time for us to get the normal She-Hulk back.
Well, hopefully they get some good inker. You know, she'll have her own series again soon, maybe. I don't know. I mean, she's going to have her own, TV show, right? A movie. What are they working on right now?
Yeah. It's supposed to be a TV show. And I got to think that's going to be... There's no way it's this She-Hulk. So I got to think by the time the movie or the TV series hits that they got to put her back. So,
right.
You know, maybe, you know, another year or two of this bad version. Now, I did see on social media earlier today, somebody was talking about how the Avengers and the Amazing Spider-Man are two like flagship titles for Marvel Comics. And they've never been worse in quality than they have been in the last 2 years. Like the quality has never been this bad for this long. And I haven't been reading Avengers, a lot of it to do with She-Hulk. Like when Jason Aaron left Thor and took over Avengers, I didn't care for the art. I didn't care for this version of She-Hulk. And so I didn't jump on, but you know, people were like Jason Aaron for so long when he was doing Thor, just loving him. And I haven't really been following it. I don't really hear people talk about Avengers. And that's another point people were making on social media. They're like, it's not even that Avengers is bad. It's that I don't know if it's bad or not, but I just know people aren't talking about it. And they said the same thing about Amazing Spider-Man. And I'm like, well, we talk about Amazing Spider-Man usually on our New Comic Wednesday episode, spoiler free. We don't give it away, but I feel like it's the same thing with Amazing Spider-Man. It basically Nick Spencer's been, it's 55 plus issues. And we're still telling the Kindred story. 55 issues, man. We're almost 5 years and you're telling the same story. Move on already. Let's go.
Yeah, I think the problem with that is like you got the diehard fans like myself that still get the book, and we'll like I'll get around to reading them when I get a chance, because you know, I know what the story's about. But we still pull our books, and I think the issue 55 is like worth like $20 now.
Yeah,
just because of the cover.
I know, and I didn't even think the cover was that great, but I mean, and I get it. Like, so I say he's telling the same story. So the Kindred story was a subplot. In the back,
just drug it on. They just dragged it.
And then finally, around 47, the Kindred plot became the main plot, and it's been that story ever since. And I think issue 58 comes out this week. So you're still talking about 11 issues where the Kindred story has been the main story, and you're talking about 46 issues where the Kindred story was the backstory or the subplot. That's just too long. It's just too long. You 4 years building up to this. it's too long. It's time to, for somebody else on Amazing Spider-Man. The art the whole time hasn't, I haven't liked it. Ryan Ottley to me is not the right artist. And then he finally leaves and they bring on Patrick Gleason and Patrick Gleason draws it like Ryan Ottley. I'm like, I don't.
There was no change.
Yeah. But at least.
Yeah. But Avengers, you're right though. It's, I still collect it. And the last, I would be honest, the last maybe 13 issues have been not that great. It's like, I don't know where they're going with the story. It's like, they're just reaching for apples here. Cause it's,
yeah,
not that great. I mean, right now they're doing the Phoenix thing. It's, yeah, like, okay.
I'm kind of thinking about picking it up because of that Phoenix thing, because that the whole who the next Phoenix is going to be is supposed to lead into the new Heroes Reborn event that sort of reboots some stuff.
Right. Well, I think the King of Black is keeping them afloat because that's actually a really good storyline.
So
I like it because I always liked Noel, because like I said years ago, yeah, when they first appeared, I was like, oh, this guy looks kind of cool. Hopefully they do something down the road with him. They finally did. So I think fans of Venom were like, yeah.
So are you caught up with the most recent Avengers stuff?
Yeah, it's not that great. And our is not that great either.
I guess.
But so. I just do it because it's my collection. I still like the Avengers. I like the characters, but
yeah,
the storyline is not that great.
Yeah, I was kind of hoping. Well, yeah, maybe let's see. There is, because I heard, yeah, it's supposed to be basically like a gladiator battle to see who gets to wield the power of the Phoenix.
Right.
That sounds like a cool idea.
Yeah,
is She-Hulk still on the team?
Yes.
And she's still the super
ugly. Yeah, yeah. Like I said, it's not John Byrne, man. I love that series.
Yeah, that's such a great version of She-Hulk. Bring her back, Marvel, please. All right, well, enough complaining about various Marvel books. We had some good ones in this episode, though. I mean, even though we didn't really dig the Daredevil art, that the Charles Soule Daredevil run is so good. Definitely recommend reading it. Guardians of the Galaxy is interesting, even though, you know, not a big fan of where Star Fox may be going. Doctor Strange is good. The Avengers No Road Home. Miles Morales is good. So plenty of good stuff in this episode. So be sure to reach out on social media and let us know what you think. But that's going to do it for this episode, everybody. Thanks for listening as always, and we'll talk to you next time.
Bye.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.